I'm Ashley Eicher.
I'm Hunter Kelly.
And welcome to an all new episode of the All Our Favorite People podcast. Our guest today is one of the people that keeps Nashville interesting for Hunter and I. Luke Dick is here.
We love Luke Dick. So he is one of the most unique songwriters working in Nashville today. He's a co-writer on songs like Killer Word by Eric Church, Burning Man by Dierks Bentley, and Bluebird by Miranda Lambert, which just earned him a Best Country Song Grammy nomination.
Yes, as a songwriter, which is so exciting. I think it's his first nomination for a Grammy.
Wow, that's huge.
It's huge. It's been a big couple of weeks for Luke, but he's just so much fun. And I was listening back to this conversation and he's so creative. He's so funny. And Luke tells some of the best stories. And he's got a documentary that he created over the span of the last 10 years about Oklahoma City's Red Dog Saloon, which is where his mother worked when he was growing up.
So I got to see this movie a while back at the premiere in Nashville, and it is just such a unique perspective. It's really him going back and looking at his origin story in a way. And his mother is one of the most delightful characters you're ever going to see on film, I promise. Her name's Kim, and we absolutely adore her.
I mean, Kim, if you're listening, we are big fans.
Big fans.
And we talk about you. We are big fans. I just love how real and honest she is. But it is fascinating, though, to go back and think about the characters that you grew up with and so many different personalities and how that shapes us.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's one of the things I thought a lot about, just watching Red Dog and just, you know, even people I grew up with and how they shaped me. I know you thought about the same thing about you just growing up in Gardendale, Alabama. And it's so fascinating to learn from people's stories.
It is. So Red Dog is streaming. You can watch it on Hulu. It's streaming everywhere on demand. We are excited to talk to Luke about the companion yes. to the documentary. It's music from the documentary Red Dog, the album. So this features Dierks, Miranda, Patrick Carney, the Black Keys, Natalie Hemby from the High Women, and Jackson Dean. I mean, it's really a singular album. Only Luke Dick could have made this project.
We're just going to get right to it because we think you guys will love him just as much as we do after this conversation. So here he is, Luke Dick.
Oh my gosh. Hello, Luke Dick.
Luke, what's
good
happening?
Good morning. I am I'm talking on a new phone and feeling a little vulnerable because it doesn't have a case on it yet.
No, what phone is it? Did you get a 12?
I got a 12. I accidentally ordered the mini. So it's actually a nice little tiny phone that you could, if you needed to sneak a phone into something or sneak a phone
like into the Ryman,
this would be the one to sneak. yeah. Who, I don't know what circumstance you need to sneak a phone somewhere, but
well, I need to at the
this
Ryman
is the one.
You know, they get really, the Ryman auditorium ushers are real intense. So you know,
well, especially if it's an artist that has decided they don't want to be filmed at all,
like Don Henley.
Who does that?
Don Henley, they wouldn't even let you have your phone out before he got on stage. Like, you could not have your phone out in the Ryman even before Don Henley got there.
He's preparing people to pay attention.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Is that what? Is
I
that
guess.
It?
Or it's just Don Henley.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, and I feel like so often artists are like, you're literally, you're not even watching the show because you're just staring at your phone the entire time recording.
I get that. It's a different kind of fight, you know, playing in bars and stuff, volume level. You had to fight sports bars to turn off their televisions, and half the time they wouldn't. So I looked at it as a challenge to try to be more entertaining than a game. Sometimes I won and sometimes I lost.
Well, I also want to say, I guess we can just say this to anybody listening, unless it's like a special guest that's only there for that show, all of the footage on a tour that you're filming already exists on YouTube. So just enjoy it because somebody else has already filmed it probably.
Yep.
Yeah. More properly as well.
Yeah. Hopefully. Well, let's talk about anyway. Dick and Red
hey,
Dog.
Y'all.
I'm so excited this day is here because when I watched the documentary, I've owned it on iTunes ever since it came out and enjoy it in my personal collection. But yeah, I'm so glad that Ashley got to watch it because I'm we're both in love with your mom. Like, and I think,
oh my gosh, full disclosure. I watched the documentary last night, okay, and by the end of it, I text Hunter. I was like, well, I'm crying and I love Luke's mom.
Yeah.
She's a lovable person. I was telling Hunter that she comes to Nashville, or pre-COVID, she would come to Nashville. She's been holed up pretty good at her house. She'll come to Nashville and she'll sit in my writing room, even when I'm having writing sessions, and sit in the corner and smoke cigarettes. And she'll tell us when a line is shitty. And then I there was a writing session one time and she didn't say anything. And then the next day I had another writing session. She was like, oh yeah, I'm feeling that. And she was like, yesterday, I wasn't feeling it yesterday. I didn't feel it very much yesterday. I'm feeling it today. She's totally dumping on my songs in here as they're being written.
I mean, what do your co-writers say?
I just tell them when they come in, I'm like, look, my mom is likely going to come out here. She'll probably bring ham sandwiches. One time she made ham roll-ups in tortillas and slid them under the door during a writing session, ham roll-up for everyone. So I just tell them, look, my mom's probably going to come out here. And I don't stop her. I don't have that many, you know, I don't know how many years, you know, I'm going to have with her, and I enjoy it. And it may be a little awkward, but it'll be fun. And so, I don't know. That's the fun thing about, one fun thing about Nashville is that everybody's pretty understanding of just about anything. So it's just an interesting observer, a spectator happening during the session. So everybody's pretty cool with it. She's a likable person. So it's a welcomed addition most of the time.
Has she thrown in any lines and gotten a co-write on any of these songs?
No. I tell you, the closest thing to that is that I was tracking a demo. I said, come out to the studio. I have to work on a demo today. And I'm singing backup and my studio's set up such that the microphone's right over my computer. So I'm engineering I'm singing some backgrounds for a song. And she got pretty cocky and she goes, I think I could sing. I got a couple ideas. I'm like, all right, mom, get over here on the mic, you know? And she throws the headphones on and starts singing, but she doesn't really know the lyrics to the song. She didn't realize she didn't know lyrics. She'd never been on headphones or a microphone before. And once you get on there, it's all of a sudden everything is hyper magnified. And also you know, so you're hearing yourself in a different light for the first time. And I've spent tens of thousands of hours doing this and she has it. And she's like in there, like kind of mumbling the words. Oh, yeah. You know, that's kind of sounded like that, you know? And I'm like, are you done yet? She pulled the cans off. I saved it. I told her about that the other day. She goes, I said, do you remember you singing background? She's like, oh God, yes. And I said, I saved it. Do you want me to send it to you? Oh, delete that, Lucas. She calls me Lucas. Delete that. Delete that, Lucas. Don't you dare show anyone.
I feel like that should be a bonus track at the end of the music from the documentary Red Dog. It's her just singing.
She would kill me. You know, it's funny. All the very personal stories that she told, but she would definitely kill me for throwing her under the bus with some background vocals. So load.
Well, I do want to ask about your mom. One of the things that really struck me from the documentary, Red Dog, and I want to ask about how it shows up in the music on the soundtrack that's coming out. It really impressed me that, you know, you said the carpet in our apartment might be 50 years old, but like the stereo equipment was brand new and there was always music. And so I want to know, you know, like making this goes back to your childhood really in a real way. And so I'm wondering how some of that music that you heard growing up, does it show up in this soundtrack?
You know, I feel like songwriting to me is there's yourself in there and there's also some character writing that's happening. And I feel like even in the sonics of a song that there's character writing. And so when I set out to make music for it, I had envisioned all the records that I loved as a kid. And sometimes I would tell my mom I was sick and I would skip school and I would get records out. And I kind of had a routine. The first song always, I would pour a bowl of cereal. And the first song always was Harry Nilsson's Gotta Get Up. Do you know this song?
No, but you know, I need
gotta
to.
Gotta get up. Oh my God, you don't know Nilsson Schmilsson?
I mean, I need to. I know the song, You're Breaking My Heart, So F You. And then, was he Everybody's Talking to Me from Everybody Talking from Midnight Cowboy? Okay.
That's him. Yeah. You're about to fall in love, Hunter.
Okay.
I think I have two copies of Nilsson Schmilsson. I'm going to give you a copy.
Thank you. I'll be right by after this.
Okay. I mean, I'm seriously, you live on the side of town, don't you?
Yeah.
I'll put it on my porch. You can just swing by
and get
it when we get off here. So when I was writing the stuff, I had those kind of songwriters in mind in terms of vibe. You know, the Doobie Brothers, and then Marshall Tucker Band. You know, my parents listened to more, I guess it would be considered alt country now, but Marshall Tucker Band. And even I feel like Hank Jr., that was the most mainstream country that was happening in our
it's
house.
It's bleeding over into Southern rock, it seems like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Did they play Hank Jr. on the radio much when he was becoming a star?
About 79. Yeah, about 79 he would have started. And then 80 he was having mainstream country hits.
Okay. And Willie Nelson and stuff like that. So these were the types of influences that I was pulling on. My mother really loves Gordon Lightfoot and the way that he tells stories and songs. And so I was trying to honestly make a record that my mother would like / love. And then also, and to have both songs that could be standalone songs, but were fantastic companions to the movie. If people had seen the movie, that they would understand. And then also, just by virtue of being who I am and of the era that I am, to not make it sound dated either. Right. That's a weird set of goals, but that was the goal, I guess, sonically and stylistically of making the record. And then there were a couple of things that were a little newer and of my era. I'm thinking of like Oklahoma or something like that, that is a little grittier with a little more sampled vibe in it. But that was sort of me hyping up the intro and being something that was a impressionistic take on Oklahoma, you know? So that was the goal.
Well, and even thinking about the track listing, like as I'm reading through it, it makes me laugh, especially when I get down to Nasty Kathy, because she was such a funny character to me in the documentary, and listening to your mom talk about her and her son and what she meant to her and what she meant to you. Like, that was one of the parts of the stories that I really loved, and also broke my heart a little bit.
Yeah, that was, I feel like the heaviest part of the film for sure was that arc of her and her son. Which I won't spoil it for anyone who hasn't seen the film. But I also felt like I had to write that song because it was my mother's best friend and I knew that she would appreciate it. And so I just asked for some images from my mom when I wrote that song of what did she like to eat? What kind of music did she like? What kind of this and what kind of that? And I remember, I think that she told me that Nasty Kathy used to dance to Steely Dan's Black Cow. I don't know if you know that song, but it's it comes in with a bass line. It's like, boom, don't. And I've always loved that Steely Dan record, which is called Asia. And I was like, I want something that groovy. And so I try to create from a groove space of something like Steely Dan's Black Cow to create something. Just for the record, it's very different. None of the melodies are the same. None of the bass lines are the same. It's just an inspiration point for all you songwriters out there. And then
don't sue me, Steely Dan.
Don't sue me, please. anyway, and then my mother said she loved Taco Bell and she loved Phil Collins. And so some of the images in the song, you know, the song is a kind of a love letter to somebody who's died and her talking to Nasty Cathy. And it's, you know, are you in heaven, you know, driving through the Taco Bell line, you know, are you playing air drums in the air, you know, in the air tonight, which is the Phil Collins song with the big drum solo and stuff like that. And I brought in Chris Dubois, became one of the chief songwriting collaborators on the record kind of by accident. And his history, you wouldn't know that he would be so into writing those types of songs with me, because he has all these hits with Brad Paisley and hits with Chris Jansen and stuff like that. But his mind for images and his willingness to dig around images and just to be in the room and serve a song is so genius to me, that he felt indispensable from a lyrical perspective to the entire record.
One of the things, Luke, that I really love about when I hear your songs as recorded by other artists is a sense of humor. Like, you know, because Luke, honestly, you're one of my favorite characters in Nashville. You make this town, like, you're one of the people I look to, like, I'm so grateful that you're here because you make this town interesting for me.
Yes.
So I just, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, I think when people think about, you know, there's a lot of comedy on this record. Like you laugh because, you know, it's pretty, there's some pretty audacious characters and there's comedy going on, but you want to listen to it, like, even after you've gotten the initial joke, you know? So I think it works on several levels. To do comedy well, it takes a lot of, like, smarts, or it takes a lot of thought.
One of the things I love about the history of country music is its history with self-deprecation. Mm-hmm. And I feel like somebody like Dolly Parton really understands this in the way that she talks about herself. But Chris Dubois' dad wrote, Tim Dubois wrote, you know, she got the gold mine, I got the shaft, which, you know, that there is such both sadness and hilarity in that package. And to me, life is pretty absurd. And I think no matter what way you slice it, and you can even have a meaningful life that is absurd at the same time. And that's generally how I experience the world. And I feel like I come by that honestly. And so I really, even when there's something that's tongue in cheek, like my mom was, you know, your mom, we remember you when your mom was smoking in the first trimester, a line like that. It's both authentic and funny at the same time, And I like that. You know, I respond to it. It's strangely sentimental to me.
Well, I mean, that goes back to, like, we didn't, you know, like, you didn't know any better.
Right.
Like, it's just how things were, riding in the back of trucks, all that kind of stuff.
My mom comes over now and she tries to feed my kids just garbage, you know. It's just like, sends them a box of, you know, this huge box of Halloween candy. And half of it I give to people because my kids can't eat 5 pounds of and sugar, you know. It's like it'll drive them crazy. Well, it was good, you know, and it's like my mom's like, it was good enough for you, you know, kind of thing. You know, if I put up a little bit of a fight, I'm like, Mom, we're trying to do better, right? I don't want diabetes. I don't want the betis in my family. You know,
we're trying to
develop some good habits here.
I love that you just said, she's like, well, it's good enough for you, because she's like, it's like that thing you look at now, like, well, when you know better, you do better, yeah. Mom. But at the same time, as a grandmother, you're supposed to spoil your grandkids.
I mean, it's definitely an ambiguous line there. But there's also sometimes I feel like there's a judgment on her parenthood when I don't do exactly the same and feed my kids exactly the same stuff, you know, that she fed me. And I'm just like, Mom, yeah, we put our kids in car seats now. You know why? Because Well, I don't know. You can just look at the casualties. There's plenty of statistics out there to tell you why we don't ride in the back of trucks. I mean, how many people do we know got bucked out of truck? I fell out of the back of a truck and got a major concussion as a kid. I'm lucky I didn't die. So there's that. Hey, if I were to make sure that I'm on the right network, would that disrupt us? Should we just keep going, or should I check pause my Wi-Fi?
If you want to check your Wi-Fi, that'd be
pause
fine.
Pause it for a second. Let me check it. And coming back.
Oh, this sounds lovely.
Oh.
Yeah. Is that so much better?
I think so.
It's pretty good. Okay. Yeah. It sounds good for me.
Okay, good, good. I was on Dick House 2. I should be on Dick House 1. If there's anybody in the neighborhood wants to come by and steal my Wi-Fi. Dick House 2 is closest to the road. Dick House 1 is back in the studio.
I nearly just spit out my coffee at your Wi-Fi name. So, but it makes sense.
I mean, part of it is like your mom being so freaking funny and who she is, but also having your last name, like what has that brought to you as far as having a sense of humor?
It doesn't even matter anymore. I remember when I first came to town, I was looking for a country deal in the mid 2000s, and every label in town was like, "Well, what is your name going to be?" And I'm like, "Well, just call me Luke Dick." We had a vice president named Dick Cheney. What's the big deal?
And
it's so funny when you kick that name to a surname, people are taken aback by it, and I've absolutely dealt with it my entire life. I had a football coach. I'm pretty mild mannered dude, but I really enjoyed football because it was like legal aggression. and so I could go out there and you're supposed to hit people as hard as you can. And Coach Dahlke came up to me and he said, you ever heard of a boy named Sue? And I'm like, of course I've heard a boy named Sue. And he's like, I think that's why you're so mean out here. You came into the world with that last name and everybody making fun of you all the time. And then you get to come out here and just take it out on everyone.
Well, I also want to remind all our listeners that Patsy Cline's husband was named Charlie Dick. Is there? And my mother would get on me if I didn't ask if there was a relation.
Well, check this out. My first name is actually Charles. And so when I had a landline, when I first moved to Nashville, I would get calls constantly looking for Charlie Dick. And I said, well, that is my name, but I'm no affiliation or anything with him. So it was just kind of a funny thing. I mean, who knows? You know, it's like somebody hit me up on Instagram and I don't really follow. It's hard to respond to everyone who sends you stuff, even though it's really nice. But a young woman named Gabrielle Dick reached out and she just said, I love this song or whatever. And I was just like, well, I just kind of have to respond to you now. And she's from Oklahoma. And I'm like, it's hard to believe that we're not related in some way, because my grandfather had like 10 siblings. And then his father was from Missouri. And so he probably had other kids. And so there are probably tons of other twice removed all over the state of Oklahoma. And so if your last name is Dick, reach out. I will respond.
I mean, it's important to support one another.
Yeah. us dicks got to stick together. Is it we dicks? Us dicks? We dicks?
What a family reunion that would be. All the extended family. You guys could do like a 23andMe and find everybody.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I've got a National Geographic genome box sitting back here from 3 Christmases ago that I really need to do the swab and see what's going on.
God knows what you'd find. Like for me, I'm just, you know, now that they're finding murderers in through that kind of stuff, like they found the Golden State Killer through genealogy. I'm like, well, I'd get some calls, I think, with my family in Alabama. I'd be like, are you kin to this person?
There is, burden isn't the right word for it, but there is some kind of a connection that happens with a last name like mine. that if you see each other on the street, it's like driving a slug bug. You know, you have to give each other a nod of some sort.
Thank you guys so much for listening to the All Our Favorite People podcast. If you like what you hear, go check out the All Our Favorite People community on Patreon. That's patreon.com/allourfavoritepeople. And for as little as $3 a month, you can help us keep the podcast growing as we add live shows and events.
We're also offering you exclusive access into planning episodes, as well as off-the-cuff interactive bonus content that we just can't fit into the show. You'll find out who's coming on the show first and possibly get a shout out on the podcast.
I don't know why I wanted to laugh at you just then. Check it out on Patreon. That's patreon.com/allourfavoritepeople. Hey, Luke, in the 10 years, you spent what, 10 years, you said, doing interviews for this documentary?
Yes.
What was the most surprising story to you? Because there's a lot of characters and so many stories throughout the documentary. I can imagine there's some things on the cutting room floor that we didn't see.
There were some pretty heavy stories that were in there, that things that weren't surprising to me. There was a family friend of ours that was a bouncer who got killed when I was a kid in there. That wasn't surprising. It wound up on the cutting room floor because we just didn't have enough information about him and his parents and stuff like that. But I can't say that there's any one story that sticks out to me, because there's a lot of really fantastical stories that happened. So they all blend together. And once my mother started talking, she was such an immodest open book that it was refreshing, and that it felt normal to me after one interview to hear, I don't know if the word is graphic or super personal stories about relationships or sexuality or whatever, that it became natural to hear those stories and refreshing, because it was honest to me. And also there was no sugarcoating happening. And also my mother is such a compelling storyteller that I was honestly just so both warmed and entertained at the same time by listening to her. This isn't one story. This is a compilation of many stories, is listening to how my mother related to people and related to people in her love life, and how it felt in certain ways, which was an inside look that I had never really gotten the picture of, you know, mm-hmm. to see the inside of heartbreak from your mother's perspective, or to see the inside of frustration in terms of a relationship, and her dealing with her own notions and feelings about being isolated or needing someone, needing a companion. Those were the real revealing pieces to me about my mother, and also gives you pause for your own self in terms of relating and relationships and notions like that I was really grateful for.
In watching this movie, it kind of reminds me of when I go back and look at my brother's Instagram account. He passed away 3 years ago, but his Instagram account was so one of the most brilliant compilations of just thoughts and images, and just really left of center. So when I go back and look at that, I'm like, oh yeah, that's my DNA. That's where I come from. Any kind of like, you know, I understand myself better, and I think other people understand me a little bit better if they know what, you know, kind of where I come from. I'm wondering if it's the same for you, because in watching this movie, I would say that I understand where your sense of humor and outlook come from a lot more. So I'm wondering if you've heard that from people, like, okay, look, Dick makes a little more sense now.
I don't, you know, that's the first time it's ever been put that way. And I appreciate that. And just as a side note, send me one of his stories, would you? Posts or something that you might think I would appreciate. I would love to see that. But I guess in retrospect, it's, even though I ended up getting a master's degree in philosophy, my mother really won't let me be pretentious. as much as I want to be sometimes. I don't know, want to be is a strong word. There's definitely a working class impulse or compulsion that's happening oftentimes. And I couldn't exactly relate to the culture of grad school in a way that some of the people and some of my friends who were there, whose parents had been to college and they were in college, and I was first generation college student. So it was, it did feel different, and it made me feel self-conscious about my own upbringing a little bit in college, because there wasn't, you know, Robert Frost sitting around on the bookshelves. There was National Geographic, was as heady as it got. And I appreciated that, you know, but my mother did always try to instill the power of education to me, and how she expected that of me and expected me to get educated. And I love her for that. And then there's also this very working class side to the family that is the pervading element, I guess, the pervading character of the family. That my grandpa did upholstery. My first clock-in job, we all worked at this airport in El Reno, Oklahoma, where I painted airplanes and painted the props and painted the painted the wings. And my grandfather did the upholstery for the aircraft. My mother installed the upholstery after it was done and all of this. And so my uncles would come in and out of working at the shop. And it's like, wow, 13, 14 years old, I'm in there just with paint blasting up my nose, you know, and it's just like, no, that's how you make money. You know, you want to make money, here's a job right here, you know, go get it. And that's how I afforded my first instruments, really, was through that and hauling hay or whatever there is to do in the country, you know, for money.
When I think you talked about your master's, and that was one of the interesting things in listening to another podcast about your journey for me, was that you were in Nashville in like the mid early 2000s pursuing a record deal and trying to write. Then it sounds like just got over it because doors were being closed, moved to New York to get your master's in philosophy.
Mm-hmm.
And then you were raising your daughter by yourself, right?
When I was here, I split up with my first wife. And she moved overseas. And so it was me and my daughter and my best friend moved out here a year after I did, and he was a lawyer and decided to quit lawyering to try to write songs. And so it was like my two dads, you know, we're eating KFC snackers, you know, and sort of juggling the bills between he and I to make sure that they got paid and there was enough food for everyone. And that was actually when I finished my master's. I was working at Yellow Freight as a forklift operator, writing songs, finishing my master's. And then when I just couldn't figure it out, there are a lot of people that I've come in contact with, especially this chapter in Nashville, young people who seem to have a better bead on what doors you need to aim at to open to make your career go, that I was either just too naive or too self-absorbed. I don't know what the word is for not just doing my thing and expecting for it to fall somewhere. And I moved to New York thinking, hey, I just need to get a PhD to where I can earn a pension and have some health insurance and all of that. And as soon as I made that decision, of course, I started making money with music. And then it was like, oh, I guess I need to be making music now, you know? So it was really a career track of hedging bets and taking opportunities where they came, really, especially when you have a kid to worry about. Where right. When I was here, I was like, how am I even going to tour if I get a record deal with this situation? And I couldn't wrap my head around it. And so that's what I did. And that's how my path went. And it definitely caused me to march to the beat of my own drum a little bit more, just because I didn't know where the band was. all I had was this one or two drums over here I was beating. And finally, when I came back, I fell into a relationship with a publisher who knew how to take what I did and put it in the right places in order for things to happen. And
who was that?
For me, Arturo Buenahora. It's a publishing company called Little Louder, and he and Eric Church are together. It's a small independent publishing company. And he's like, you need to be writing with Eric and Dirks. And these are people that I help with. So we're going to do our best to get you in those rooms and see what happens. And then of course you meet all manner of other songwriters and collaborators along the way that also help you with your own craft. And I can't say enough how much Natalie Hemby and Shane McAnally early in my career, and I'm still early in my career, really, how much they helped me to both have confidence and believe in me and also treat me as an equal when I didn't necessarily deserve that treatment early on because I had nothing to show for my creativity so far, except for a Hilton commercial or something like that, you know.
Well, I'd heard you talking about kind of what brought you back to Nashville with Arturo is hearing Eric's song Smoke a Little Smoke, which I remember when Eric, so I started covering him from his very first single, but it was so funny because like there was such a disconnect at the beginning of his career between what they were putting out to radio and what you'd seen his live show. Because his live show from the beginning, like, you know, he like fractured bones from stomping the stage so hard. Like it was so intense. Mm-hmm. And so I remember when Smoke a Little Smoke came out, it was finally like Eric gets to be himself, you know, and then of course you have the Chief record after that. So for me, it totally makes sense that that was kind of like, oh, this is where I, for you, it was like, this is where I can come back into the mix. Because for me, it was also like, I look at that moment as a real game changer for Eric to be himself. And yeah, looking back, it was a pivotal moment for
the team. I heard it and... in New York. And that's what, when I heard it, I said, is this what they're doing in Nashville? Because I might have a chance if that's what's happening. And of course, at that point, that's not what they were doing in Nashville at all. It was what one guy was doing and what Jay Joyce was doing in the studio. But Eric's perspective was interesting to me and something that I found relatable and listenable. And I remember on my first trip into Nashville to meet with some people who might sign me to a publishing deal, I listened to country. And before that, it was classic country that I was listening to that was my bearing for what country was, which couldn't have been further from the truth or further from a realistic perspective on what I would really be tasked with as a writer. Mm-hmm. But the hope that I heard on the radio was Alan Jackson's talking song Repair Blues, which was by Dennis Lindy. And do you know that song? Do you guys know that song?
I mean, I know Dennis Lindy.
Is this crazily, crazily creative lyricist, songwriter who wrote most of the songs by himself, not all, I think. And the song is about a songwriter who breaks down and this mechanic tries to take him for a ride by telling him all this crazy shit that doesn't even go wrong with cars. You know, it's like, you know, your water pumps down half a quart, which anybody knows anything about cars, water pumps aren't actually down on water. It's the radiator that pumps water through. And anyway, the second verse, the mechanic realizes that he's a songwriter and says, hey, I got a song, you know, you might listen to this. And he said, I listened to it. I gave him my most sorrowful look. And he said, lyrics like, I can tell you've been using a cut rate thesaurus because your adverbs are backed up into your chorus and your verses are running on verbs that are way too weak.
I have heard this song. Yes.
And then the songwriter ends up taking him. He said, just go on and fix my car and chances are I can fix you up for $700-$800, which is $100 more than what the guy said he would charge him to fix his car. So good. And I was like, wow, that was, you know, a real relationship to the humor and absurdity that I gravitated towards and thought, well, somebody's doing it in town. You know, somebody's doing something that I like and relate to on a real level. That's what I should aim for. You know, the problem is I keep relating to people that are people like Eric and Dennis Lindy that are such quirky people within the genre that it's not an easy road, you know. None of it's an easy road, number one, but it's even harder, you know, when you're trying to sort of till that kind of land.
Well, yeah, but what I love, Luke, you are just like you are just exactly who you are, which is one of the things I appreciate most about you, Hunter, talking about you're one of the people that for us keeps Nashville interesting. And I, when I think about some of like my favorite songs that you've written, it's like Pretty Bitchin', which is Miranda Lambert and White Trash, Kit Moore's The Bull, mm-hmm. Cassie Ashton's Taxidermy, like people that are within the genre that are exactly who they are. Like as soon as I hear them, I know that it's Miranda. I know that it's Kip. I know that it's Cassie. Like, I mean, is that important to you as a songwriter to work with those types of artists?
You know, it seems to work that way that you've, I look at songwriting as some kind of a Venn diagram, you know, in a, as a creative process where you're you and you're this circle, they're them and they're this circle. Then there's the public that you can't even think about at the time, if they're going to relate to something or not once it gets out to them. And so you're trying to find that special place that you and the artist or the other writer that you're writing with can overlap. And with all those artists, I feel like there's a place. And even sometimes the most unexpected overlaps can happen because we're all human. And at a very primal level, we all want the same things. I feel like that's one thing in this day and age that is hard for people to remember is that there are so many basic things about being human that are similar from human to human. It doesn't matter what kind of music they like or what kind of shows they watch or whatever, the things that we need and desire in life in terms of relating, in terms of needing other people, needing to be validated in certain ways. That's a unifying aspect. There are unifying aspects of being human. And that's what I tell myself when I look at my calendar and say, I don't know if that makes sense, but I'm going to try it because they're human and I'm human. We'll see what happens.
Yeah. Okay. I think at this point we do need to talk a little bit about some more songs on the Red Dog soundtrack. One of the things with this is that people will look at the soundtrack and be like, wait, Miranda Lambert's on this. Dierks Bentley's on this. Patrick Carney's on this. Like, So to me, it's a testament of like what we've been saying about you. I hope your self-esteem is really getting a boost because we love you, Luke.
I love flattery. So
let's talk about, you know, having Miranda on Polyester. I wanted to ask you about, first of all, explain what the fabric polyester means to you.
This is most, if you had curtains growing up where I'm from, the curtains were most certainly made of polyester. Any church attire was most certainly made of polyester. And it's this very readily available, some would call it cheap, Hunter, material, inexpensive or thrifty might be a better, more appropriate word to use, but it reminds me of my childhood, that material. And the song itself it's not about sewing or material. It's about kind of spiritual material, I guess, being that this is the kind of material of where you come from, and it doesn't matter how tailored your suit might get for the CMAs, you know, this is the cloth that delivered you in a way. And I feel like that's what the song is all about. And early on when I wrote the song, my publisher was trying to pitch it to people, and Miranda was somebody that I tried to pitch it to. He even thought that it would be a good pitch for Florida Georgia Line, and I thought, I don't really hear it. And he's like, well, it's unexpected and this and that. And I'm like, well, you do you. If it gets on the radio, I'm happy. And the record rolled around. Nobody had cut the song. And I actually didn't envision it as being part of the soundtrack until the music supervisor I was working with, Carter Little, he was talking to me about sonics and some of the sound beds and score, of giving me some references that I might look to. And he goes, and of course you're going to put polyester as the credit track. And I was like, really? And he's like, of course, it's your story. And that's one thing that Miranda said is like, that's totally your story. She says, I love this song like more than anything. And I said, well, how about this? How about you just come sing it with me? And she's like, of course, I'll sing it with you. And so it wasn't that big of an ask. We were riding together. And so I said, just come sing it. We'll do a thing. And she came over and it was easy. You know, it's like sort of in her past, in her blood, so to speak. And I think most anyone in this town writing songs and being an artist, even, you know, that their background is fairly polyester.
Yeah.
Isn't that the truth?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Like, as you're talking about, even when we were talking about carpet earlier, like that made me think about my parents' basement, which still looks like this, is like all wood paneling still around the basement from like the 70s when it was built. And then they finally got rid of the shag carpet a few years ago, but that shag carpet I can remember as a teenager.
My stepdad is still out at the little farm / plot of land that I was raised, and they have marijuana is legal in Oklahoma now, and they've turned my room into a grow house. So I get pictures back and it's like, is this what it took to get new carpet in my bedroom? It was like, there was no carpet padding. It was just this old red carpet. And it was it used to be the garage of a house, and there was no insulation in this room. And in the summers, it was so sweltering in the house. We had eventually got a window unit, but my room was still hot as hell. And so I found a piece of wood outside and took a saw to it and made a kind of a little base at my sliding window and hammered it in there so I could set the fan up there, a box fan into the window, and it would blow cool air on me, or as cool-ish air on me at night. About 3 a.m, it would start feeling quasi-comfortable in there.
Hey, I had something I wanted to ask, follow up on. So on this show, we like to talk, you know, when we have someone like you whose creativity and process we want to know more about, I like to ask about this kind of thing. I'm fascinated. I heard it on another interview that you did, that you have been listening to or learning Scott Joplin and Chopin on the piano.
Yeah.
How does that kind of practice open your mind up, or help you kind of introduce new ideas?
Practicing the piano, to me, I haven't had a chance to do it. It's been a year or so since I've been in lessons. But getting on the piano and learning other people's music, like the greats of Joplin or Chopin, you can start really digging into the brilliance of somebody musically and see how they work out. There's a melody going on, and then they will work it out to where these variations of the melody within the song, the 2-minute song or whatever. And Scott Joplin, I was reading and learning, I think it was Peacherine Rag or something like that. And I've always loved that barroom sound, you know, of something like The Entertainer or something. And so I'm learning this stuff, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of half steps, you know, you know, that kind of stuff. And I don't know how much it's worked its way into my music. My piano teacher was like, you need to work these really weird chord progressions. Work this into a country song. I'm like, that ain't going to work. That ain't going to fly, you know. But when I was around in Scott Joplin, messing around with that, those half-step melodies were really cool to me. And it made it, those movements and melody made it into the verse for Pink Sunglasses.
Oh, yeah.
It wasn't a radio song. It was on Miranda's. I put it on to memorize it. You know, that was like me learning Joplin and creating melodies in a similar fashion as Scott Joplin. And he's such an American great, you know. I was like, well, it makes complete sense to put that in there. And it's so cool, his sensibilities. So it's a real joy, and my schedule got busy, and piano requires everything, requires so much time to get good at. So I kind of dropped off because you really need to spend about an hour a day on it, which I couldn't dedicate. But I just thought this would be awesome as I get older. I could see myself when nobody cares about Luke Dick songs anymore, I'll just go start taking piano lessons again and learn from the greats and see what happens. And maybe I'll see a second great wave of Luke Dick songs after I get back into piano. I don't know. Who knows?
I mean, like, look at Bill Anderson.
Yeah, Bill Anderson. Tom Douglas keeps his fire lit pretty well. You know, it's like you ride the circle and it takes you high and then it brings you back down low. And then he's just such a lover of songs and stories that it comes back and you don't know what your career path is going to be. So you just feel it and you follow it. And maybe Scott Joplin will bring you back around.
Or like Bill Anderson, you can make a disco record, which I'm featuring on the New Year's Eve edition of my show on Apple Music.
When did he do that?
79. It's called Lady's Choice.
I thought you were telling me that Al Anderson just did a disco record.
No, Bill Anderson.
Like Bill Anderson.
Whispering.
I thought you said Whispering Bill. I thought you were saying that Bill Anderson just did a disco record, which would have been news to me.
Yeah, no, he did it in 79. But
that's amazing.
But I celebrate it. And I actually got, when I lived in a condo, I had an ongoing feud with my upstairs neighbor over noise. Imagine that. So one time she called the cops on me, and then they came in, and I played them. Well, I was just listening to Bill Anderson's disco record. So the cops really got it. So, I mean, there's a little bass, but it's nothing crazy.
Why am I not surprised, Hunter? Why
I know. Luke, oh my gosh, the Red Dog soundtrack.
I can't wait for people to hear it, and I hope that people love it and see the movie and relate to it in some way. It's special to me and feels like a concept that needed to be explored and told, and I hope that it's relatable to people everywhere.
Have you thought about a musical?
I've been gunning for an EGOT.
Yes.
I haven't gotten any of the letters yet. But,
yeah, but you know.
It's
long-range planning.
Time. Yeah, you got to have goals.
You got to put it into the universe, as the New Agers say.
That's like, yeah. Who was that? Speak it into existence.
I love helping people plan EGOTs.
Yeah.
Trisha Yearwood is halfway there. And so I'm just like, well, we just need to figure this out. I'm like, let's go do a Broadway show for a Tony.
I would love it. Will you walk me down the red carpet and tell all the other reporters what they need to ask me when I'm going to the Tony Awards?
Yeah. And I'll be there. I'll be really awful. I'll be like, don't ask about this, and then wrap it up like real quick.
I accidentally got on the red carpet at my first ACM. I didn't know how to get into the building, and I walked down. I was up for Song of the Year, and I didn't know how to get into the building, and I figured that the red carpet would lead to the building.
Yeah, eventually.
Yeah.
I got on there. And
it's
I
a long carpet.
It is a long carpet. I didn't have a publicist, and there, everybody was like, who the f*** is this guy? And people start asking me questions, and I didn't look over here, look down, and my hair is all messed up and stuff, and half of them. And so I'm just sort of, I feel like that's something maybe analogous to my whole career, really.
Oh my gosh, I love it so much. So good.
Well, Luke, yeah. I mean, one last thing and then we'll go. When you were doing The Entertainer, I realized that's what's playing on this ice cream truck around my neighborhood. But the battery's dying. Yeah. So it sounds like it.
Or the lesser entertainer? The lesser entertainer?
Well, no, it sounds like demented, so that I'm about to be murdered or something by an ice cream truck killer or something. I mean, maybe this is because I watch nothing but serial killer stuff anymore.
I was going to say, that feels like a Law & Order episode.
Yeah. I mean, well, yeah.
It's an X-Files episode. You know, they had one with this... Yeah, doll that came alive, and they played Hokey Pokey all the time on before the doll would kill someone, you know? Oh my gosh.
Bless God. You, Luke Dick.
Oh, Luke,
bless
thank
you guys. Thank you guys for having me. I appreciate it.
Okay.
We loved it. We'll talk soon.
It sounds great.
Why am I not surprised that Luke walked onto the ACM red carpet and basically stumbled onto it?
I mean, I really think looking back that I remember that moment. Of course, it's not out of the ordinary for songwriters to walk the red carpet if they've been nominated. Right. So I didn't think anything of it. I had no idea that he just kind of showed up. But, you know, Luke Dick, he makes himself at home wherever he goes. And that's what we love about him.
I know. He can kind of do whatever he wants. And we're like, it's fine.
Yeah. And thank you for that. I did drop by and get that Harry Nilsson record. So thanks for that as well, Luke.
I want to hear that record. I'm going to have to come to your house. But I just love this conversation, and Luke cracks me up. I know we said that at the top of the show, but I think you can tell after you listen back through that. If you guys haven't gone and listened to some of the music he's created, just go check out Luke's website, some of the hits that he has.
Yes, lukedick.org. I didn't know he was a nonprofit. .org.
Luke, are you a 501c3? We got to talk about this.
You've got to talk about his tax status. It's very important, Luke.
Anyway, you guys go follow Luke on social media. You can find him on his website. What is it again, Hunter?
LukeDick.org.
Make sure that you check out the film Red Dog. The documentary is available on all of your streaming services. And obviously go listen to the record, music from the documentary Red Dog. You can find us on social media at All Our Favorite People. You can find me at Ashley Eicher. You can find Hunter at Nashville HK. Make sure to rate, review, and subscribe. I mean, we'd really appreciate it, especially around the holidays.
Oh, yeah. If you want to get us something for the holidays, do that.
Yeah. Or maybe share about the show on social media if you love it, you know? Yeah. If you don't love it, you can just text us or send us a direct message. Oh, my gosh. We love you guys. We hope you're having a great day, and we'll see you next week.